Retina Rounds, podcast number 33. Today we're diving into what it really takes to start your own retina practice. We'll discuss the upside of autonomy and ownership and the very real financial, operational, and lifestyle challenges that come with it. Our guest is Dr. Nadim Vaidya, who will share his journey and playbook for anyone considering going out on their own. Let's check it out.
Hello and welcome back to the Retina Rounds podcast. Today we're honored to welcome Dr. Nadim Vaidya. He's the founder and owner of Retina OC, a private practice in Irvine, California. Dr. Vaidya has served as both a moderator and panelist at the Business of Retina meeting hosted by the American Society of Retina Specialists. And today he's going to share with us some pearls on what it's like to start your own private practice. Nadim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be on the podcast.
Well, so Nadim, tell us a little bit about your process to getting to starting your own practice. Obviously, it may not have been something that you were thinking about early on, but maybe it was. So tell us about the path that you took towards actually starting your own practice.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, coming out of fellowship, I didn't really think that starting my own practice was something that was feasible. You know, I think we all kind of hear the stories that it's a ridiculous amount of money to kind of start up. And like, you know, you coming out of fellowship, coming out of med school, you know, we're saddled with all these loans. And I think taking on yet another loan or taking on yet another expense just seems like too much. So when I left fellowship, I took a job like most people do. And I was an associate for a small practice in New York. You know, I think after a few years and it was a couple of things. It was, I think, I was moderately happy with the job. But I think my wife wasn't very happy in New York. She's a native Californian. And so I think it's hard to move east from California. It's easier to move, I think, west from the East Coast. But I think, you know, with that, plus with my, you know, not extreme happiness in the practice, I guess, let me put it that way. I think that it was something that we kind of thought about moving out west. And when I looked for jobs out here, there wasn't really anything that kind of piqued my interest. And I think I had always thought that with, and one of my jobs at the new practice was to kind of make everything digital, I guess. And with that kind of business process in mind, I thought that, you know, it would be relatively easy, hopefully, or it could be feasible at least to open up a practice. I was inspired actually by a blog run by a doctor named Hosan Choi. And I reached out to him and just kind of, you know, basically asked for his advice. And, you know, he was very forthcoming, as I've tried to be kind of since that. I think it just kind of inspired me to open up where there wasn't really necessarily an opportunity where I wanted to be.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And, you know, I suspect that a lot of people sort of have this idea in mind, right? That, you know, the this idea of, well, I'm not totally satisfied where I'm at, or maybe I really want to be in a geographical location and the right job opportunity just isn't available to me. And an option always is to start a practice on your own, but it's, as you said, it's such a daunting task. There's so much that we learn in medical school, residency, fellowship, and beyond, but none of that really prepares you for starting your own business per se. So there's the business aspect of things. There's the finances that you alluded to earlier. And also, when you're thinking about a saturated market or a highly competitive market like Southern California, it can be a little bit daunting just, you know, hanging a shingle and trying to figure out how am I going to get patients into my office and not lose money along the way. So I'm sure all of these thoughts maybe were running through your mind, but how did you kind of come to, you came to the point where you said, okay, well, I really want to consider opening a practice, but what are some of the first sort of feasibility tests that you did to figure out whether this was even going to work for you?
That's a good question. I mean, I think we actually, and now I think it's a lot easier. You could probably use AI to help you. At the time, this was around 2011, 2012, that I kind of started researching and kind of thinking about this. And at the time, what I ended up doing was I went through the census data. At the, the Census Bureau has something called the American Community Survey, so intra-decile. Now, I guess everything is intra-decile. They're kind of rewriting congressional districts on a daily basis here, but that's besides the point. But intra-decile, when they're not doing the census, they kind of are doing still a count, but they're also collecting other data too. So, like the age of people in the area, things like that. And between that and looking at the ASRS database, looking at the AAO kind of, find a doctor website and things like that, I tried to just kind of put everything into a big Excel sheet, map it all out, and kind of find where there might have been like a spot to hang a shingle. In retrospect, I think this is probably more work than was needed. I think anywhere you go, whether it's the most saturated place or the least saturated place, I think there's always some, there are enough patients to go around, and there's always some business that that can be made in that area, no matter what. Patients are getting older by the day, and I think any population anywhere, whether it's in the heart of Manhattan or, in Orange County or up in LA, as you're probably noticing, I think it's, relatively difficult to lose money as a physician. It actually doesn't take that many patients in order to break even. And I think that was the kind of misconception that I had, that I really did need to kind of find a spot that wasn't being served. As it turns out, ironically, it is actually technically a spot that wasn't really being served per se, by anyone sort of local to where I was. There was a big regional hospital where I am, and the nearest retina person was 10 miles away in any direction. And that's including UC Irvine at the university around here. They were probably 10 miles away from my location, and the population was kind of steadily, I didn't know this at the time, but it was kind of steadily growing northward and north eastward. That proved to be a huge boon to my my goals. But since I moved here, two other people have moved in within, about a mile and a half from where I opened up shop, and relatively recently. But as far as I know, and frankly, I've been busy in my own right, but I think that they're doing okay, from what I know. But yeah, no, I did a lot of work to kind of figure out like a sweet spot. At the end of the day, it probably isn't, as long as it's a place that you want to be, that you want to live, I think you can make it work pretty much anywhere.
No, I think your point is really important, which is that there's business, enough business to go around. Our patient population is expanding, and patients are living longer, and so there's going to be an increased demand, a need for good retina specialists. I think the key thing is, as long as you do a great job, you will have no difficulty building a practice. You can think about all the different strategy and location, and there's all sorts of different ways to think about how to build a practice. But ultimately, I think if you take good care of people, you treat them like they're your own family, it's pretty hard to screw it up, as you said. It's really hard to not be successful.
Yeah, no, and the three A's you hear about in fellowship: the affability, availability, and ability. I think it's so true. I know, I think it's a bit of a cliche, but so much of it comes from just being like a friendly, approachable physician, and someone who kind of generally cares about patients. And I think, I think, I mean, I hope that that's what I am. but I think that patients, appreciate that, and especially if, like we kind of talked about earlier, I don't know if I, you had asked, or you, I guess you, when you had spoken to someone else, they had mentioned how, it's not so much the volume in my case, that I'm trying to seek out. It's sort of the quality of care. Now, I don't think my quality of care is any better than anybody else's, obviously. Well, maybe I'll say that to myself, but not to anybody else. But no, and seriously, it's, I think I provide, patients with that time to kind of ask questions, and I don't feel the need necessarily to see 80, 100, 120 patients a day, like some folks in the area might. I think I'm pretty happy with how things have kind of panned out so far.
Yeah, no, that's interesting too. I mean, there's all sorts of different ways to build a solo practice and kind of carving out a niche. And there's a lot of talk of creating a concierge medical practice that's certainly become far more popular. Is that kind of what you had thought about as far as your own practice? Are you planning on building a sort of a concierge or a boutique style retina practice?
I think boutique is probably closer to, where it, or closer to what I was aiming for, where it was, equipment that, I thought that was state of the art, and, provides, I think, patients with a more comfortable experience. And, even from the furnishings in the office and stuff like that, I kind of wanted it to resemble sort of a, I guess, luxe, for a better word, environment. Whether or not it is, I don't know. Whether or not it succeeded, I don't know. But that was the intent, at least. I think, so many, and I had worked per diem at a couple of places when I first started out, in order to kind of, keep revenue kind of coming in, or keep cash flow positive at the beginning. But there were definitely places that I worked where that was not the ethos, that was not the guiding light, so to speak. And I think I concierge, or like the direct primary care, that sort of model, I don't know if I think what well, that may be another discussion entirely. I don't know how well that works in sort of a retina atmosphere. But that being said, I think that we could provide that kind of concierge level service to our patients, and not feel burnt out by the, I guess, that level of service. I still kind of have a very sharp demarcation between home and life, I would think. My wife may disagree on that, but I like to think so.
So what are some of the things that you, in retrospect, were glad that you thought about and glad that you looked at? And on the flip side, what are some of the things that you wish you had spent a little bit more time thinking about or investigating when you were in those early stages of starting your own practice?
I think, that's a good question. I mean, I think the mistakes that I made initially were, sometimes choosing the wrong vendor, for my phone system, for instance. Actually, initially, when I first started up, and this would also have been arguably maybe I don't know if it was a mistake, but it was definitely a different way of growing. But I opened up my own office only one day a week initially, and kind of grew outwards as I expanded. And I had worked at other per diem jobs, namely, Kaiser for a couple of days a week. And then I kind of slowly peeled that back as the years went by. arguably, I probably grew slower as a result in my private practice. But I think I grew at a pace that was fine for me. And I was able to, I think the circumstances of when I opened up kind of maybe sort of molded the way that I tried to start up the practice, because we had a baby about 6 months into when I opened up. We purchased our first house right around the same time, a few months after I opened up as well. And so the bills were coming in, and responsibilities were coming in. I thought that cash flow and revenue would be more important than growing the practice as a kind of independent sort of thing. I think that in retrospect, could I have grown faster? Yes. I think the other on the flip side, I think I ended up doing just fine either way. So it really just depends on how you want to approach it. I mean, the other thing that I truly regret is actually getting the kind of the whole kit and caboodle Heidelberg system way back when, the one that came with FA, OCT, fundus photos of multicolor, their fundus photo equivalent, and the wide field and all that stuff. At the end of the day, I probably should have waited and gotten the Optos and when I was cash flow positive, instead of spending as much as I did. I probably could have paid a third of that and just got an OCT, which would have been fine. Like I tell other people, every mistake that you make with the purchase, you can always rewind. I rewind my phone system issues pretty easily. I had outsourced my receptionist service initially, which is a horrible idea. But generally speaking, I think there's nothing that was a truly irreversible issue that I couldn't have overcome later on, or I couldn't have changed later on.
Well, it sounds like, especially if the office is open a day a week and you're spending some time, generating money, doing per diem work, you have to try to keep your expenses low, right? You have to run sort of a lean ship because you can't have a bunch of people on payroll and you're only there a day a week. And that
Exactly.
probably is a good, probably, I would imagine, is a good philosophy to have just in general, especially if you're not trying to have a high volume practice. In order to make this make sense for you, probably keeping your overheads as low as possible is a big factor in that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I started off with one staff member as just to man the front desk and the phones. And even that was one day a week at that point. But eventually, as I grew, and I did all the teching myself and things like that, so being able to kind of do everything in a practice, kind of the DIY part of it, I think is helpful to kind of keep costs low. The only problem with that is that sometimes it's hard to find the right time to let go of the DIY part and kind of outsource it to somebody else. But I think that is, you're absolutely right. I think it's a very important part, is trying to keep the expenses low, while you're kind of building up that volume.
Right. So let's just go back. You're just starting out. You've decided where you want to be. You have an idea of the type of practice that you want to build, the type of equipment that you want. What are some of the other things that are on your list, right? I mean, do you take on legal counsel to help you negotiate your lease? How do you decide on your electronic health record system? How are you going to do your billing? Walk us through, like, what are all the different sort of list things on your list that you have to address in order to actually open up for business?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is obviously the lease and kind of finding a place. But just, like a home, you kind of you go around, you see open houses, you see open locations, open offices, and you kind of aim for what you're trying to. Obviously, you don't in a high cost area like you and I live in. Rent can be pretty expensive, even for a relatively small space. So I think having enough space that, day one, it's not too much of an expense, but then it also you grow with it and you can grow into it over the course of, a typical commercial lease is 5 or 10 or 15 years. My initial lease was 5 years. Now that said, I didn't actually get outside counsel to help. I did enlist a friend of mine who just kind of looked it over, who happened to be a real estate lawyer. But it's I think it wasn't it was a very cursory overview. But I think for the most part, most of these agreements are very boilerplate, and people like your agent. Your real estate agent that may help you find this this office space can be able can help with that sort of stuff. Even with an architect kind of getting a floor plan for the place that you're building out is helpful. And but that frankly kind of came as at least for me it came as part of my lease and part of my sort of the build out cost at the beginning. And that was actually something that my broker helped with as well. So I found that generally speaking, it wasn't all that necessary, even for things like incorporation. People sometimes go through a lawyer. In this day and age, you can file all the paperwork online pretty easily. At the time, just perhaps for ease, I did end up, doing it through Biz Filings, which is like a online filing platform. You could use Legal Zoom nowadays. All of those things are, again, pretty boilerplate. They have packages that they kind of give you, and you fill out all the X's and O's, and it kind of does it for you. So much of what we do is actually not something that really needs that legal representation. I think even, things like accounting, initially I kind of looked at accountants to kind of see, but actually, as it turns out, I just to set up my books, I hired a QuickBooks trainer for like an hour session, one time. And was able to kind of set everything up, and now QuickBooks does everything for me, for the most part. I do have somebody file my taxes, but that's like a line I will not cross, just because I'm lazy. Aside from that, I think a lot of it just kind of boils down to kind of putting one step in front of the other and one foot in front of the other to kind of get the space, start the credentialing, start the kind of the infrastructure, getting the payroll, at least the infrastructure for payroll, even if you're not, if you don't have any staff members yet, set up, getting things like a web presence set up. So many of our patients are looking for their next doctor online. I hate to admit it, but I look at Yelp for pretty much every restaurant that I go to, and a lot of patients do the same. They look at Google, they look at Yelp, they look at other places to kind of make sure that they find the doctor that other people have gone to and have been happy with. So kind of developing that web presence, developing that marketing component to it. Is helpful as well. Obviously, that's not one of the first things, but ironically, it was actually the first thing that I did was I bought the domain name for I bought a couple actually, but I even bought Retina LA initially because I wasn't sure if I was going to end up in the LA County region. But Retina OC obviously was where I kind of ended up. But yeah, my wife thought it was nuts when I spent the first week of my decision to go into practice to kind of build out my website for my non-existent practice without an address.
No, those are, I mean, look, as you said, there's a lot of steps that you have to take in order to finally open for business, and each of them is important. Finding your location, deciding how you're going to manage payroll, whether that's on your own or outsourcing it. Especially if you have a lean practice, a lot of that you can just keep in-house and keep your costs down. And as you said, there's a lot of digital tools that are available to small business owners, including physicians, that really streamline that whole process.
Absolutely.
Eventually you do open for business, and or you're close to opening for business, and you've got to figure out, well, how am I going to go out and make sure that the community knows who I am? You've got a web presence, of course, that helps. But how did
Yeah.
you decide that, well, there's two questions. One is, did you think about, like, what kind of a practice am I going to have in terms of which payers am I going to work with? And then also, how did you go about introducing yourself to referring doctors so that you could have patients coming into your doors?
Yeah. Well, to kind of maybe I'll hit the second question first, but I think just kind of casting a wide net, and my old boss in New York said that you never know who's going to end up referring to you. It's usually the people that promise you patients night and day are going to be the patient or going to be the folks that send the fewest or never send at all. And it's the referrers that you may never have met, that just kind of, randomly sort of found you somewhere. And maybe it's by word of mouth, maybe it's by something else, but then they send you their lion's share of patients. I think, initially I cast a wide net and I kind of went out and you tried to meet as many people as I could. One of the things that I noticed very early on was that it's very hard to get past the front desk if you're not bringing treats and preferably something sugary with you. So donuts became sort of my mainstay, cupcakes became sort of my mainstay, and it was so much easier to kind of get in and talk to the doctor. But almost invariably, it was without any of that stuff, just carrying a bunch of cards in my hand. It was impossible to do anything but get to the front desk, and then not an inch past. Between that and actually, I found, and this may come as a little bit of heresy, but I feel like that face-to-face, pounding the pavement and pressing flesh, so to speak, was actually relatively low yield, despite my donuts. It didn't really generate a lot of referrals, with one exception, with the primary care doctors who actually I think did get to kind of know me as like one of the few people that kind of came directly to them. But I actually found that, and I know you said the web presence, but I think the direct to patient marketing, nobody in our field does, or very few people do. And I think that was a big boon. And actually at the beginning my Google AdWords account was probably a 10 to 1 return on investment, whereas I don't think my donut spend was nearly as efficacious in terms of how many patients are brought in through the door.
So direct to patient or direct to consumer advertising, that's primarily you're doing that through digital means. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. So Google AdWords. I did other things, maybe less like Bing ads. I don't even know if Bing is a thing anymore. Bing ads. Facebook people can do, but I find that maybe that's kind of aiming towards a younger demographic than maybe we treat. Although like even that's getting older by the day, I think. But yeah, the majority of it was Google AdWords, initially.
And then in terms of thinking about payers and which type of payers you're gonna work with, are you also casting a wide net, or are you restricting it because you have a certain type of a practice that you want to build and you feel that certain payers are gonna allow you to do that better than others?
At the beginning, beggars can't be choosy, and I think I decided to kind of try to take everything, with the exception of Medicaid initially. And I'll kind of go back into that in just a moment. But with all the other commercials, I tried to get on as many of them as I could. I think one thing that I didn't realize at the time is that there is, even for solo practitioners, even for solo practitioners without any sort of footprint in the area yet, you can still negotiate a smidge. It's not great negotiating power, but friends of mine were able to kind of negotiate some increase in what they were initially offered. Now, that being said, at the beginning, I just kind of took whatever was given to me. And fortunately, things like Medicare, it ends up being still a majority of our business, even with all the patients on Medicare Advantage and things like that. You're still 60%, 50, 60% of your revenue is probably going to come from Medicare patients. So the rest was icing on the cake, so to speak. And I wasn't able to get on the few HMOs in the area, which in retrospect was a blessing. A lot of them were capitated plans, where they only paid you a certain amount per however many thousands of lives. But those were kind of pigeonholed into certain, or I guess monopolized by certain, single physicians or single physician groups in the area. For Medicaid, at least at the time, they were paying roughly like 20% of the Medicare allowable, for kind of day-to-day office visits. Whereas they did pay reasonably well for procedures and things like that. I think, and I kind of did the calculations to what my ratio of procedures to office visits would have to be in order to make it worthwhile. And it was some outrageously high number. I think it was like 80% would have to be procedures, which maybe arguably the Medicaid population is a higher, has more acuity of care or acuity of needs. I think I at the time I made the conscious decision maybe not to play necessarily the volume game, and not to kind of go after the most number of patients. I wanted to, and frankly, at the beginning, at least personally, I kind of wanted to grow slow so I could recognize the mistakes I was making and fix them before I grew too big, too fast. And I think by doing that, I sort of got my processes honed that, I don't necessarily need to. I mean, I don't necessarily need the staffing, I suppose, to kind of do the extra legwork that may have been required for some of these other non-PPO Medicaid plans where there's a lot more manual work, getting prior authorizations, things like that. So I think it helped in the long run to keep lean. I don't know if it was the right move, but it was a move. I know other folks in the area kind of choose the opposite way, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think I think if you actually kind of go and look at what the cost differential is for the practice, it even for certain commercials, the pay for office visits, like Blue Shield, for instance, is terrible. But they're completely unwilling to negotiate with anybody. It's a universal uniform fee schedule for everybody in California.
Yeah, and look, I don't want to get too far into the weeds of the whole payer system here, but I think I just wanted to bring it up in the sense that I think it's something for doctors who are just planning on starting their practice. It's kind of important to think about, which payer mix you would like to have in your practice, and does that align with what your practice goals are? One of the things that I think you mentioned early on is that you've struck a really nice balance between having a busy, successful practice and also being able to have some time with your family, which is also obviously very important. And so, as you think back on how you've built this practice, what are some of the things you mentioned that you were able to kind of correct course along the way as you've been able to grow more slowly? What are some of the things that you th what are some of the decisions you made or some of the corrections that you made that really allowed you to strike that good balance between having a vibrant professional career but also giving you enough time to be able to spend with your family?
I think one of the main things that I did was to utilize OR time that at my AC that wasn't going utilized. There were some cataract surgeons that were coming in at 9:30 on Wednesdays. And one of the things that I did was I just had a, excuse me, a late start every Wednesday. Which allows me a little bit of kind of a cushion to kind of get some, work done even around the house, just kind of maybe sleep in a little bit sometimes. But it allowed me that sort of pressure release valve, where if I had a patient that came in with an RD, and that I needed to take them to the OR, that slot would usually be open. And kind of having that ability to kind of slide something in once a week, even if 75%, 80% of the time it goes unused, it was nice for my peace of mind, to kind of have that pressure release that I didn't have to necessarily search for OR time elsewhere. I think eventually I also came to the point where, I only have ASC privileges. So my ability to take cases after hours is somewhat limited. And I think finding that balance between, wanting to kind of necessarily take everything that comes your way, versus, realizing that, look, it does it make sense for me to reschedule a half day of patients to take this patient to the operating room when someone else might be available earlier. And whether it's the university, whether it's another retina specialist around here, I try to do what I think is best for the patient. And frankly, what's probably best for my sanity too. And so, if I can't get them on in a time that's reasonable for them, for a MAC on detachment or even a MAC off detachment, I try to give them a few options and kind of try to help to figure out their disposition to kind of help them to kind of get to the next person. But I don't break my back, I think, trying to make sure that everything that comes into my office is something that I necessarily have to fix. Especially if it's at the to the detriment of my family life or to the detriment of my sleep or my my work-life balance, so to speak. Now I feel like sometimes the pendulum might swing a little too far one way or the other, especially nowadays. I feel like sometimes the work-life balance is more life than work. But I think, to maintain your sanity and maintain your, and this is something that we have to do for what, 40 years potentially. We don't want to get burnt out in the first 5, 10, 15 years of our practice. We want to be able to run this marathon and kind of continue going on. And I think, the way I practice now, I feel like I could do this until I'm 90. Maybe not the surgery part, but I could I'm happy with what I do. I don't leave the office necessarily very tired every day. And when I do feel sort of irritated or burnt out, I take a week's vacation, and that's enough to kind of recharge me for the next few months. I can always tell when I get annoyed at certain things that it's time for vacation. But taking that time for yourself and making sure you kind of protect that time, protect the weekends, for instance. I don't take call in hospitals. I don't, I try to kind of round things up nicely during the week, so I don't have to, I haven't taken a patient call, meaning I haven't needed to take a patient call over the weekend in quite some time. I think that contributes to our happiness, not only in our practice, but in our life as well.
Yeah, and that's really, I think, particularly important in solo practice, right? I mean, when you don't have
100%.
other colleagues that you can lean on, you really have to think hard about how you can make this a sustainable venture. Now, maybe you had some idea that you would want to take on an associate later on after you've built the practice. You're shaking your head. It sounds like that's not at all. And so that's what I wanted to ask you next is why solo practice instead of a group practice? Like why, or I understand starting the solo practice, but maybe adding on associates later on, but that doesn't sound like something that you're interested in, and I'm sure there's a good reason for it. I wanted to know what that reason is.
I mean, I don't know that there is a good reason for it. I think it's just, I'm happy enough. And I think that, for the additional headache that it may cause to kind of bring on an associate, to not necessarily just the associate part of it, but obviously now there are two cooks in the kitchen instead of one. I mean, I think it also exponentially, I joked with my wife when we had our second kid, that two kids is about the equivalent work of about 10, I would say, or it feels that way. One is okay. You can kind of, tag team as parents and kind of save the other from overwork. When you have two, they outnumber you, even though it is technically two to two. There's a headache involved with bringing on an associate, which kind of exponentially increases the complexity of a practice. You have to get more space. You have to get a satellite office. You have to make sure that many more staff members are available to help. And when I'm doing okay, and I'm happy in my salary. I'm happy in, what I take home. I just, and I reserve the right to change my mind in the future. And for any future associates that may be hearing this 20 years from now, I apologize. I just can't, I don't see myself doing that at the moment. And I think it's more, again, more just for my sanity rather than any good reason for it. I don't know. I think there's a dearth of introspection in our field to some extent, where we think that there's a happier spot down the road. I think we're built to be very aggressive, not aggressive, very competitive. And we want to be the best retina specialist. We want to be on the podiums. We want to be, seeing and enrolling the most number of patients in a clinical trial so we can get our name on a paper. I think sometimes that's hard to let go of because that's how we got here in the first place. I don't know. I just don't. There's a point at which happy enough is happy enough. I just, that's not a great answer, I don't think, but
No, it's the best answer in my opinion, right? Because I think that, as you said, very few people can have that level of maturity to recognize that what's really important in life, and that The grass isn't always greener, that the constant pursuit of more and more and more doesn't really lead to fulfillment or contentment. And I think getting to a point where you can actually say honestly and be you can say that, hey, I've got everything that I want and need. And
Yeah.
more isn't necessarily better. That's actually, people spend their entire lives trying to get to that point, and so it says something that you're at a point where you feel like you've been able to achieve that. And I think that that's a really important goal for a lot of our viewers, especially our young viewers, to keep in mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think so many of us kind of think that we want to, and even like the fellow solos, some of them want to build a, a gigantic multi-state corporation, and they want to become the new RCA or whatever it may be. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's ever been, that's never been on my radar. I would love if my kids went into it. I would hand it off to them at the end of my practice if somebody came to the area that when I'm about to retire, and not my kids, obviously, but I mean if my kids don't go into retina, which I don't know if I want them to or not, but that's a whole other story. But if somebody comes to my office one day, and I'm in my 70s, and I'm like, you know what, I'm done. Here are the keys to the practice, and good luck and congratulations. Or maybe I'll just kind of close up shop at the end of it. That's the thing. And for me, forgive in a short aside here, but I've never quite understood the whole buying and selling of practices, to the extent of, how it makes sense for, other people to kind of come in, especially in this day and age. I think patients are loyal to a physician that they've seen and that, talks to them, that, has taken care of them for a long time with empathy. I don't think that translates. I don't think that you can, we're not cogs in a wheel, in so much as I think a lot of the private equity firms are starting to realize. And again, no shade towards the private equity firms, but I think that, with people kind of coming in and out, it's not as easy as kind of saying, here's replacement X for Dr. Y. It the patients don't love that. And at the end of the day, I don't think buying or selling a practice, you've already gotten your money out of it. I've already gotten my money out of it. At the end, why would I sell something for an imaginary number where it's for the sweat equity? But the sweat equity is what I put into it and I've earned over the last, in my case now, 16 years, but or 13 years, I guess, 16 years since fellowship. But I don't see the reason why people pay for that outright. I mean, obviously people do, and maybe it's because of in a built-in referral network or things like that, where if the name doesn't change, maybe patients still come. Or maybe it's because their chart is still there.
Or maybe they don't have an insurance that allows them to switch to a different group that's close by.
Or that too. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So if they're capitated, or if they're yeah, no, that's a good point. But that being said, I think, there are many reasons for patients to leave, and for patients to be loyal to their physician if they're a PPO. And the majority of our practices are still Medicare plus a PPO, or Medicare and or a PPO. And I mean, I don't know if that's the same everywhere, but at least in my neck of the woods, and I think it's for the vast majority of folks in the US, it's still the case. To some extent, I think one thing that you had asked me about earlier that I forgot to mention was, how you decide on an EMR. I think, that's probably one of the easier decisions, I think. Just kind of going with what you know, but and or kind of trying everything out. And most of these places will kind of give you a walkthrough, will give you a demo, will allow you to kind of play around with it. The places that allow you to play around with it, I think, are probably the best, because then you actually get to learn what working with them is like. But the reason I kind of segued into that was that nowadays, with electronic medical records, I think it's so easy for a patient to just grab all their records. All my patients can download all of their chart notes in PDF from, the patient portal anytime they want, and they could go see the guy down the road. But they don't. And, I think in this day and age, it's hard to kind of keep a patient captive to your practice. Especially if you're leaving and bringing on somebody new.
So for some of our fellows who are listening or watching, maybe some of our recent grads who are thinking about starting their own practice, in your opinion, what are the personality traits and maybe the levels of risk tolerance that are appropriate for somebody to really consider starting their own practice?
Well, like I said, it's actually very hard to be a failure, I think, as a physician, at least in retina and in ophthalmology in general. Other fields of medicine may not be as easy, but I think we generate enough revenue per patient that we don't end up actually having to see as many patients to make a good living. And I don't know if risk tolerance necessarily plays into it. I think it's more of a BS tolerance. And kind of dealing with like the random stuff that happens on a day-to-day basis, and kind of just rolling with the punches. I think the risk is very low. Now, I tell fellows coming out of practice that they should have, and not so much because of a risk thing, but just because of a cash flow thing, they should try to have about 18 months worth of expenses as a backup. And I meant personally, not as a corporation. And generally speaking, and this has almost been the case throughout every practice that I've advised or I've kind of talked to and given advice to, is like almost everybody gets into the black on sort of a day-to-day basis within about 6 months, plus or minus a month or two. And then they get into the black on the whole and are net positive by month 18. So if you have 18 months of expenses built up and that you can live off of, if you have a spouse that happens to work and earn a decent income, then I think the risk is very, very low. I think and I think that goes to my first thing about like being tolerant to BS, I think, is having a malleable personality, having someone that doesn't take things too seriously, I suppose, and too not everything is sort of Chicken Little, the sky isn't always falling. I think that's a great personality trait to have, where, as long as you don't get too worked up about the small inconveniences, the small, back steps, I suppose, the small sort of setbacks. That's what I meant to say. Setbacks that you may have in practice. I think that's, a great personality. And I think the more type A you are, it helps in certain things to kind of be detail oriented. But I think the stress of it, if you're very type A, is maybe not as easy to deal with. So having like a type A with like a type A detail with a type B sort of let it come as it may sort of personality, I think would be great.
Yeah, I think you may have answered this question already, but looking at your practice now and thinking about the future, how does your sort of definition of a successful practice or what you'd like your practice to be. How is that different now than perhaps it was when you first decided you were going to open the practice?
One thing that I may not have paid as much attention to initially was, to make sure that all the stakeholders, and when I say stakeholders, I mean, like my wife, like my staff, and that they're all happy with how things are going, and kind of checking in with them and making sure that they're on the right track, for their careers and, for their home life as well. As opposed to just kind of looking at just the numbers and making sure that, I'm earning a salary, and I have some profit at the end of the year. But I think, making sure that for your location, for your market, that you're able to kind of provide staff also with the reimbursement that they want, that they need, to kind of have a living wage, and having the benefits that they actually appreciate, which 401ks are generally something that I feel like not very many office staff necessarily appreciate until they get to retirement. But I think that ends up being more for us. But things like health insurance, things like getting a scrub benefit on a year-to-year basis, kind of those like small little niceties, I think, of a practice that I think are helpful for retaining good staff. And I've been very fortunate to have retained good staff, even though I may not have been very cognizant about that initially.
No, you're absolutely right. The work environment, the work culture, that's not never going to be a pleasant place to show up to work if everyone is unhappy and feeling underappreciated. And that translates into the type of experience that patients are going to have. They can sense that. They can sense when a team is pulling in the same direction and happy and energetic and enthusiastic about the work that they're doing, as opposed to practices where it's just a paycheck and people are sort of begrudgingly coming to work. It's a completely different experience. And I think that you're right. If one is striving to achieve, to provide the best level of care, part of that is really not just about what you do as a physician, but the type of culture and the team that you build, the environment that you're building, and the people in your office are so critical. They're the first impression that a patient gets and the last impression that they'll have before they leave.
Absolutely. And I think, building in that autonomy for, your staff from, the receptionist to the tech to everybody, where they have the ability to kind of say, like, this isn't working well or that isn't working well, and let me change it. And, is this okay to me? And kind of letting those kind of smaller fry sort of things that may not mean a lot to us, trusting your staff to make the right decision when given a little bit of leeway, I think is a huge part of happiness and the happiness via autonomy at work, I think. But also, putting in the mechanisms where there are certain things that they don't have to do, for, so many folks get manual reminder calls, or they get they sent out bills or things like that. I've tried to automate as much as I possibly could of the things that I could do that didn't require a human touch, so that they could kind of focus on the day-to-day in the office patient experience. Patients can book online, they can book via text, they can book via an AI voice bot on my phone system. And that for each patient that isn't kind of going through to a human telephone receptionist, that's one less thing that they have to do outside of kind of making sure that the patient is treated well in the office.
No, that's great. I think that's very forward thinking. Look, Nadim, I'm so grateful that you spent some time talking to us. This was a little bit more of a sort of general principles and philosophy of starting one's own practice, which I think is very important. It always starts with the concept. Obviously, we could spend a whole hour on any one of these number of topics of, choosing equipment and staffing and all these different decisions that come into play when starting one's own practice. And we'll have a deeper dive into some of these subtopics. I hope that you'll come back and share your thoughts and your pearls when we do have those discussions. But just want to thank you so much for sharing your experience, your thought process. I think that it's really it's remarkable because it's sort of old school medicine, so to speak, being in solo practice, but it's sort of going back to what really I think drove a lot of us to want to pursue a career in medicine, what was really important to us. And I think that you've really sort of crystallized the importance and what's valuable in being a physician and built a practice centered around that. And I really want to commend you for being able to do that and sharing that experience with us.
Well, thank you very much. And but it's been a pleasure kind of speaking to you about this, and I'm always happy to come back and talk about whatever you want to talk about. I try to be an open book for anybody that's kind of going into solo practice, or frankly, even people are kind of like looking at I have friends that are kind of trying to figure out whether or not they want to get bought out by PE. And I'm always happy to kind of give my two cents to them. And I think this is a great platform. I thank you for kind of creating this platform so that people can get this knowledge, which they can't get through fellowship, they can't get through med school. And so much of what you do and to kind of help to propagate this information. Not just obviously the business side of things, but obviously the surgical videos are kind of a key part of your podcast and video series. I think it's great. So thank you for creating the platform.
Well, thanks all around. Thanks to our viewers for watching and supporting and submitting videos. And we'll look forward to speaking with you again soon, Nadim. And thank you again for taking the time.
My pleasure. Have a good night.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website. And you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.